God has really blessed me. You know, he let me work in D.C., let me work with EIB in Hollywood, in Silicon Valley. And he's shown me through all those experiences that there is one problem and one solution, and that's why we do this show.
Welcome to A Disciple's View with Todd Herman.
When the God of the universe created the world, he didn't snap his fingers or wink his eye. The Lord spoke. He said, "Let there be light." Because we believe, we speak about the happenings in this world, mindful that our true home is with Jesus Christ and his kingdom. I'm Todd Herman. Welcome to A Disciple's View. I don't mean this to be particularly snarky. Is Dan Crenshaw okay? The congressman from Texas? I mean, he's most identifiable because of the eye patch, which is not his fault. It's just maybe to bring him to mind. He was doing an interview with a journalist, and as the interview was wrapping, and they were both walking away, the journalist asked Dan Crenshaw, a United States congressman, and as I understand, it's a decorated combat veteran, have you ever met Tucker Carlson? And Dan Crenshaw said, well, we've talked a bunch on Twitter, but if I ever met him, I'd probably blank and kill him. And I'm not kidding. Is he okay? And does he hear himself? You shall not murder comes to mind. It also comes to mind that he works in Congress with some pretty villainous people. He works with Nancy Pelosi, who is a villain. He works with Ilhan Omar and Pramila Payapal, or Jayapal. I call her Pramila Payapal. He works with Dan Goldman. He works with Jasmine Crockett. He has watched our troops sent into places like Mogadishu with actually no prospect, none, of getting our guys out of that. That's the Black Hawk Down incident. I just watched a documentary on that and talked to some friends of mine from the teams. And all three of my friends said, yeah, we knew you can't use a small team to go get those guys out of there. We knew it was a suicide mission. That's Dan Crenshaw watched this happen. He served during that time, as I recall. Maybe a little later. And he wants to kill Tucker Carlson? Now, this gets worse, believe it or not, because a congresswoman asked him, Marjorie Taylor Greene asked him on Twitter, did you threaten to kill my friend Tucker Carlson? And he replied, LOL, no. Except there's video of him doing just that. This is the same congressman who was asked about his insider trading and his stocks. And he, as I recall, said, what are you talking about? And a lot of expletives, a lot of cursing. I don't have stocks. And yet his financial disclosures say otherwise. So I'm genuinely asking, is he okay? Genuinely. I don't know him. I've never met him. But I think Speaker Johnson should sit with him and say, are you okay? And by the way, it's not okay to threaten to kill U.S. media personalities or journalists. You don't get to do that. And I actually believe the FBI should give a knock on the door because Dan Crenshaw is a guy who is capable of killing Tucker Carlson. And Tucker Carlson's response on Twitter was proper. He said to Dan Crenshaw, hey, why don't you come down for an interview? We'll see how you do. I'll give you my address. There's all sorts of panic. I mean, you see this. We see this, I think, with Dan Crenshaw. I think Crenshaw actually worships systems. I think he worships the intelligence services. And I think those are icons to him. And I think idols. And we're seeing all sorts of idols. The panic over DOGE continues. And I'm watching a shift in tactics. See, the left is deeply frustrated because there was a poll that showed that 70% of Democrats think there should be a department to fight waste, fraud, and abuse in the government. 40% of Democrats support what DOGE is doing or trying to do. This is deeply troubling to Democrats. They cannot put a bead on this. So they're shifting tactics. You can see this on social media. The tactic now is this. Well, they're not really cutting anything. It's all smoke and mirrors. The same people who are applauding an upside-down American flag at Yosemite Park, obviously put there by federal employees, is now saying, well, they're not really cutting anything because the other tactic's not working. But it is surfacing things like this. This is simply a private citizen. He is a United States pharmacist. He happens to run a pharmacy that doesn't take insurance monies. So part of this is self-promotion, and it's good job at self-promotion. So this pharmacist has another message for Elon Musk and Doge for saving Medicare money.
This is day 5 of helping Doge cut waste. So far, we found 4 drugs that Medicare is overpaying for by $3.3 billion. And today we found another even bigger one. It is aripiprazole. This medication was dispensed 7.2 million times in 2022 at an average of $208 each. That makes the total that Medicare spent $1.5 billion in 1 year on only one drug. At my pharmacy that doesn't take insurance, that medication costs $12. If we filled all 7.2 million of those, the total cost would be $86 million. That means that of the $1.5 billion that they spent, more than $1.4 billion of that was wasted. That happens because Medicare, just like private insurance, uses a pharmacy benefits manager to tell them how much the medication should cost. They use a made-up price called the AWP, and then they get to discount that so they pretend that they're saving us money. After that, they send you to the pharmacy that they own so that they can collect all that easy money. It's a disaster, but it's easy to fix. Cancel the PBM contracts. Ditch the made-up prices and get back to reality. If you want to see how much they've been overcharging you, go to forestparkpharmacy.com to look at our price checker and see how much you could save. See ya.
Really smart marketing. Really smart. And great analysis. And I think he offers a great alternative. Sadly, it's not just private insurance companies that do this. There are some Christian healthcare sharing ministries that tell you that they negotiate better rates for surgeries. I can tell you firsthand, that is not true. I can tell you firsthand that the negotiated rates for some of these organizations are actually far, far higher than you would pay in cash. And these are some Christian healthcare sharing ministries, which you're not to lie. Senator Rand Paul revealed to the United States Senate that U.S. taxpayers spent $4.8 million in Ukraine for social media influencers.
$4.8 million spent in Ukraine for social media influencers. While you're at it, we spent, not we, but the people who vote for this, I've voted against all of this, but the members of the Senate who voted for this spent several hundred thousand dollars sending designers in Ukraine to the fashion show in Paris. It goes on and on.
And incidentally, you are also have been forced to write checks to full-on fake media companies in Ukraine that you actually set up with your money through USAID, and those so-called media organizations literally pretend for the benefit of the Ukrainian people that there's no real conscription going on, that people aren't being seized and kidnapped and taken to the front and forced to fight, when in fact that is happening. You paid for this. But Doge is just frightening. They asked people to say what they're doing for their jobs. Have you ever been in a job where you are told to report what you've done for the day? I've not only been in those jobs. I've been in a job when I was young in playing in a rock band in Seattle. I wasn't say rock. That's not fair. It's a pop rock. And playing that with my best friends who brought me to the Lord Jesus, I sold Time Life books on the phone. I was that guy who called you and tried to talk you into buying Time Life books, and I was really good at it. And during that job, my progress selling books was on a whiteboard in front of a room full of 30 or 40 other people doing the same thing, and we were racing and competing with one another right there. And during that job, my boss would sometimes monitor my phone calls and sometimes would even speak into my ear, giving me advice on how to complete the sale. And it was actually great boot camp sales training. And our evidence for our production was up there every single day. When I worked at a pizza place, We did a count every single night of how many pizzas we cooked and sold, how many came back to the kitchen, did we have any returns, what were the satisfaction rates. It was a great pizza place. And every night when we hit our quota, we got to take free pizza home that we cooked on our own. It's cool. At Microsoft, our meetings, casual, we had with our boss once a week, casual, coffee, 10 minutes, how are things, often just talking about life, how are you personally, is there anything I can help with? Every other week, we had formal one-to-ones. How are you doing on your commitments? How are your goals working to get your commitments? What can I, as your boss, do to move things out of your way or better resource you to get done what you need to get done? And then once per quarter, we'd have a specific quarterly meeting to track our progress towards our end-of-year goals to earn more stock and more money. Constantly measuring how we were doing so the bosses could help us do a better job. When Elon Musk said, email me or email and reply with five things you've done this week, it was literal fascism. That's a fascist move. As you watch this unfold and you begin to see people screaming into the blood moon because they cannot put a bead on this because 70% of Democrats say we should have a department like this. 40% of Democrats like what DOGE is doing, that there is theft and corruption being unveiled, that a pharmacist like the guy we just played can talk about, here's one way tomorrow that you could save $1.5 billion on one pill per year. This is all getting through to the American people, even Democrats. So they cannot help themselves but say insane things. Jasmine Crockett, a nominal member of Congress whose job is to say silly things, fulfilled her duty speaking about DOGE.
Now, President Trump says he likes the idea of giving some of the savings from DOGE back to Americans as kind of a dividend. Would you support that?
Listen, he's just telling a lie. He's not the one that had anything to do with the $1,200 refunds that people had during the midst of COVID that was done by a Democratic House and Democratic Senate. Right now, what they're going to do is say, hey, we want to give you a refund, but Congress won't let us because they already know that there's just no money for that. The only reason that those refunds came before was because we were living in different times. This was a time in which hopefully we won't ever go through again. We had a once in a lifetime pandemic. The bad part is that I don't know if it's once in a lifetime because we know that Ebola, unfortunately, was detected right here in New York here recently. And if we continue down this road of getting rid of scientists or deciding that we don't want to rely on experts as it relates to what they're telling us to do, or we don't want to deal with vaccines and medicine in this country, then we may be facing not only our next pandemic, but our next two, three, or four pandemics because of their incompetence. So no, we are not in the business of giving out money. And honestly, I don't know what $5,000 will do for you.
Let's just take that apart as a silly sandwich. I don't know what $5,000 would do for you. Oh, it can pay many people's mortgages for a couple of months. It could pay off a car that you are struggling to pay off at a high interest rate. You could invest it. $5,000, Jasmine, is a lot of money. I know you don't know that because of your net worth that has skyrocketed since you got into Congress. Gosh, how did that occur? That's a real mystery. And she wrapped up all the so-called pandemic stuff in that. What we had money, it wasn't a refund. It was $1,200 they sent people. At the same time as you had the Federal Reserve inventing debt and calling it money, sending it to the Treasury, to give $3.6 trillion to the Treasury, who gave it to big businesses twice, each time illegally. The $1,200 was so that we wouldn't notice the $7.2 trillion illegally given to big companies during the COVID lockdown hoax. We'll come back, and together we'll be in the world and not of it. I'm Todd Herman. This is A Disciple's View. appreciate you listening to Disciples View. Todd Herman, the devil is so busy in the destruction and division business. It's really fascinating because the Lord Jesus told us the truth when he said, I have not come to unite, but to divide. The devil doesn't come out and say, I've come to divide. And Jesus is divisive because Jesus is truth. He is love, he is compassion, he is light, he is mercy, he is righteousness, and he is truth. And truth is divisive. And the devil divides through lies, distortion, depression, distracting people. But he never comes out and says, I'm here to divide. If you look, and please do, and please, gosh, when you do this, please, I beg you, fully put on the armor of God. And I mean verbally communicate that you're putting on the armor, and verbally work with God and the Holy Spirit to make sure you put on this armor, and then go spend some time looking at what's called the Satanic Church. Do you know how they pitch this? They pitch it this way. It's about freedom. The Satanic Church is about freedom and love. You'll see these signs at their events. Satan loves so-called trans kids. Satan loves so-called trans adults. And it's freedom and it's love. It's you are to love who you want to love. And Satan loves that. And he loves all your loves. And he wants you to have this freedom. We played a few weeks ago a pastor, a female woman, who said that Eve made a great decision when she decided to eat of the forbidden fruit. That this is one of the closest of the ways that we come close to God. That was one of the most godly things she could do. It brought her closer to God. Original sin brought her closer to God. That is a satanic church masquerading as a Christian church, but there are actual satanic temples. And that's their pitch. Come and be loved. Come and have freedom. And they will couch this in so long as you don't harm another. Because we know Satan doesn't want to go on harming people. And they're growing. And so it's time to really put on that armor, investigate this and look at it and understand that the reality is there. It's an opening of the Overton window. That's a political theory by where certain conversations, what's allowed in a conversation, what government's allowed to do, what you can say on TV, expands over time. And it's an expansion in the Overton window as Satan is building his religious organization, his army. You were watching, in my judgment. We're watching the preparation for the end days now in ways that we never, ever could have imagined. And so much of this is being done racially. And Satan loves racism to remain a pain point. We can understand it as a sin issue. Because hating anybody is a sin issue. God said, love your neighbor. And some people will say, yeah, but not that neighbor. And sometimes that's racial, sometimes it's economic, sometimes it has to do with culture or habits. And Satan loves it either way. But the racial component to this has been so agitated and so pushed that here's a question I have. Where is forgiveness? In all the discussion of reparations, where is forgiveness? Because the Lord Jesus taught us to forgive people, our enemies, 7 times 7 times, he says. No doubt to the frustration of Peter, who is saying, how often do I have to forgive? And there are people, and perhaps they're even well-meaning people, and maybe almost certainly are, PhDs even, assistant professors of New Testament at Wheaton College, people like this, authors, published authors, successful people, who talk about racism in the evangelical church, but I never hear them call for forgiveness. One of the key components of following Jesus is to forgive, and sometimes forgiveness is hard. One such gentleman is, in fact, an assistant professor of New Testament at Wheaton College. He's an author of a book called Reading While Black. He's a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times. And here, Esau Macaulay describes what he sees as a growing divide in evangelicalism.
I think there's emerging like a division within evangelicalism. Mm. And this division isn't between, like, it's not a theological division between liberal and conservative. It is a division between people who see in the Bible, God's concern for the poor and the disinherited, and say that a part of our Christian witness needs to be there. And there's another segment of the church that's saying, anyone who talks about this stuff is a liberal, and we need to avoid them.
That's a fascinating view. Now, I can't say that I've ever seen that manifest in a very large evangelical church in one of the most conservative parts of the United States of America, and that's North Idaho. In fact, I was in our church when our pastors announced that there had been some churches that were mostly attended by black people in the South had burned down, or actually, forgive me, had been burned down. As part of the Black Lives Matter Incorporated riots, they got burned down. And we raised money to build those churches back. And I sat in the pews, well, not pews, it was just chairs, it's a big evangelical church. And I sat there and I watched as people stood and applauded at the amount of money that God allowed us to raise very, very quickly. I've watched as our pastors go to Africa and spend significant time there, not just sending money, but down there teaching African pastors how to make disciples, how to take small groups and turn them into big groups. And we've invested a lot of money in buying for people farmland and farm implements and teaching them how to have their own water, how to get it clean, how to raise pigs away from the water, etc. And because this farming is not, it's not their background. And we've watched that explode. And I've sat in the church as we have celebrated this and seen people stand and applaud this. It doesn't mean that we don't have racists in our church. In fact, I can tell you that I've heard from people I love, you know what, we should do more at home. I get so sick of seeing our money go out of the country. And yes, we should do that, and I'm proud of it. But we should really do more at home. And when I've heard that from people I've loved, I've just said one thing. Does Jesus think so? Or should we do as much for everybody as we can? It's never been race-based. I don't think this is a divide. I don't think what Esau Macaulay said there, despite him being a PhD, I don't think that's a trend. I do not believe there's a trend in the evangelical world of people saying we should not give to the poor. We should not identify with the least of these. Do you see that as a trend, anybody, in evangelical land? So going back to his discussion, Esau Macaulay then goes on to promote heresy.
I think that when the church isn't telling the truth, any heresy will do. And so I think there are a large group of young Christians who know in their heart what they're seeing is wrong, and they will gravitate towards anyone who says that this is bad. And what I want to say is there is a biblically faithful, theologically sound road towards justice. And that you don't have to abandon these historic pillars of Christian orthodoxy in order to contend for the things we think are important.
So the things that he thinks are important are DEI programs and things like reparations are important. But again, it begs this in my mind. Where in any of that comes forgiveness? I was in church this past week. Oh my gosh, this was embarrassing. I was such an awful child. When I am low in blood sugar, I get hangry, and I can be a jerk. And I was really low on blood sugar, and I was headed to church, and I was late. I hate being late to church. I mean, I wasn't late, but I wasn't gonna have the petty pleasure of having my seat, because there's a seat I like to have. I want my seat. I'd gone and seen my friend Ben, who's my sports med doc, and got my shoulder worked on, so I'm running late. And I get into a truck-to-truck dispute. I felt like this guy was blocking me from getting in this lane and getting to church early. I'm sure he felt like I was going too fast. So it's one of these things that we had. And I quote one, I pulled in front of him, but they felt like I was cutting him off, and I probably was. I cut them off. And I turn right and they turn right. They go, oh, great, they're going to go to my church. And yes, then the guilt started to build up. And I'm getting out of my truck and this guy slows down and he looks at me and he's waiting for me to say something and I'm up in my flesh. And so I was a child. So I argued with him in the parking lot. Well, you could have split, you know. just a child. And his wife said, look where we are. Look where we are and how you're acting. And even then, I knew she was right. My flesh is all in the way. And I go inside to the church, sit down, and I'm already embarrassed. And then they come in and they're laughing. Like, oh, great, we have to sit by this guy. And this guy took off his jacket. He's really muscular, super muscular. And he sits down with his wife, and I started to think about communion. Oh, I can't take communion and have this problem with this brother. I can't do that. The Bible tells us. I can't even tithe. Oh, I had to walk over to him, and I did. And I stood there for a second, and he looked at me really suspiciously. And I said, I apologize to you. I was wrong, and what I did was wrong. My name is Todd. And when I said my name, he kind of lightened up. I'm Roger. I said to his wife, madam, I'm so sorry that I caused you to feel uncomfortable this morning. It was irresponsible. You're exactly right. I have no business doing that as a Christian. And I please ask you to forgive me. And at that point, he stood up because I spoke properly to his wife. And he embraced me. And he said, we're all human, brother. I forgive you. And it's so funny because afterwards, I was talking to one of the pastors. And he said, oh, hey, I saw that you met Roger. I go, yeah, funny how that happened. And I told him how it happened. He goes, man, I'm glad you guys worked that out, because last thing we need is the two most muscular old men fighting in the parking lot. I go, that guy would tear me to pieces. Forgiveness. This is never in these conversations that are race-based, or maybe not, never. But I've never seen that. Esa McCauley teaches at a college, the New Testament at Wheaton College, and I don't hear him saying anything about forgiveness. So go back to his comments here. This is Esa McCauley comparing Pentecost to social justice warrioring.
When the flames of Pentecost came down and the people of hearing the gospel preached, there were two responses. One response was to say they were just drunk. And the other response was to ask the question of meaning. What does this mean? And so what I want to say is, if there's a movement going on in the church for justice, and if it's from God, if it's of the Spirit, there are two responses. One is to do, they're just drunk. It's a way of saying the African-Americans and the mm-hmm. and the Latino and Latino brothers and sisters and my Asian-American brothers and sisters, they're just cultural Marxists. They're just social justice warriors. They're just people trying to liberalize the church. That is the same thing that they did at Pentecost, where they used what they could see as an interpretive lens to dismiss what was going on.
So he's speaking here of justice. He's speaking here of justice in the DEI sense, which is fire white people, hire black people, which is rig systems like they did at Harvard. They openly rigged the system against Asian men, openly. And so they could get more black men in, black men who were not yet ready for Harvard. Some might never be. Just as I would never be ready for Harvard. It's not who I am. It's not how God made me. But they were rigging these systems, and no favor to people who aren't ready for that college and might never be going and then failing there, but not before spending a lot of our money, taxpayer money in many cases. He is in favor of income redistribution being forced. And he's speaking of justice in the church. Okay, maybe Jesus should have rethought that thing on the cross. Because slavery is aberrant. We cannot lovingly own people in bondage. I mean, there are decent slave owners. George Washington was a very, very decent slave owner in terms of how he treated people and housed them. And he was a slave owner. But maybe the Lord Jesus should have rethought that whole thing on the cross. Because if I'm understanding Esa McCauley correctly, when Jesus Christ on the cross said about people who had scourged him, beaten him, attempted to humiliate him, hammered him up on a tree, and he looked out and said, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Maybe what he should have said is, man, Father, bring down the legions of angels, and I want you to make it bloody. He didn't, because he went with perfect submission. And then when he rose, and people learned that he rose, think of the conundrum in their minds. Oh my gosh, he was the Son of God. But he didn't stop them? No, he forgave them. Why? Because he loves you so much that he fulfilled that mission. Yes, the sin problem of racism should be approached just as the sin problem of adultery should be approached, just as the sin problem of fornication should be approached. But none of those things, having been approached, work without forgiveness. After the sin is dealt with, after we take it to the cross, after it's washed in the blood of the Lord Jesus, after he forgives, we're going to be forgiven in the same way and measure. My big concern about the Esau, like, Macaulays of the world, Esau Macaulays, is that they're teaching people that the sin of refusing to forgive is not a sin God's keeping track of. The entire New Testament tells us otherwise. We'll come back on The Disciples' View. I'm Todd Herman. We'll get to the tire babbling and a personal note. Just to clean up a little business today. Just one trend. I just want to make you aware of this, and maybe you're aware of it. If so, forgive me for being repetitive. Are you tracking the effort that the left is making to do away with elected sheriffs? This is happening in all the separate countries. There is no longer an actual sheriff. In King County, Washington, that's the county in which Seattle sits. So that person is now appointed by the county commissioner. So not an actual sheriff, but a politician's plaything. Now, this is the way they're doing it. Okay. They're explaining that having an elected sheriff is expensive, super expensive, because you have to do the election and that's really expensive. Does the left care about expense? No. Mail-in balloting is expensive. They don't care about expense. This is another tactic. A sheriff is in a position that voters just don't have the ability to research. And so voters just don't know how to pick a good, qualified, legitimate sheriff. It's just not, it's not a good position for that. So we shouldn't have elected sheriffs. So what's their alternative? Think of this. Elected sheriffs are bad because voters aren't qualified to pick good sheriffs. So let's let politicians elected by voters pick the sheriffs. But wait, I thought voters weren't good at picking people to be in office. Oh, no, they're good at picking county commissioners, but not sheriffs. So what's the real drive here? Obviously, the real drive is to make sure that every sheriff's position is debated. They want it to be county councils who do this so they can moderate the sheriffs so that the leftists on the council have to debate the more conservative people on the council, so they have to come to some agreements because they know they can do that. They know they can flood the zone with enough candidates for county offices. They can flood that zone and get enough people elected, even in relatively conservative areas. And that way they can debate the sheriff, because what they don't want are sheriffs who support law and order and sheriffs who support the Constitution. They do not want sheriffs, for instance, who are going to work with ICE. In Maryland, there's only two sheriffs right now who will work with ICE, and they're both elected. Separate country of Washington State, elected sheriffs are saying, we'll work with ICE. The non-elected are saying, we won't do it. Well, they can't, because their bosses are politicians who are making money through illegal immigration. So I want to make you aware of that. One other thing, then we'll get to the tire babbling. An advisor to President Trump, Stephen Miller, recently went after the media for lying to Americans about Joe Biden's mental decline for years before calling out federal bureaucrats.
It is true that many of the people in this room for 4 years failed to cover the fact that Joe Biden was mentally incompetent and was not running the country. It is also true that many people in this room who have used this talking point that Elon is not elected fail to understand how government works. So I'm glad for the opportunity for a brief civics lesson. A president is elected by the whole American people. He's the only official in the entire government that is elected by the entire nation, right? Judges are appointed, members of Congress are elected at the district or state level, just one man. And the Constitution, Article 2, has a clause known as the vesting clause, and it says the executive power shall be vested in a president, singular. The whole will of democracy is imbued into the elected president. That president then appoints staff to then impose that democratic will onto the government. The threat to democracy, indeed the existential threat to democracy, is the unelected bureaucracy of lifetime tenured civil servants who believe they answer to no one, who believe they can do whatever they want without consequence, who believe they can set their own agenda no matter what Americans vote for. So Americans vote for radical FBI reform, and FBI agents say they don't want to change. Or Americans vote for radical reform on our energy policies, but EPA bureaucrats say they don't want to change. Or Americans vote to end DEI, racist DEI policies, and lawyers of the Department of Justice say they don't want to change. What President Trump is doing is he is removing federal bureaucrats who are defying democracy by failing to implement his lawful orders, which are the will of the whole American people.
That is so well said. And it goes back to why the left does not want elected sheriffs. They want election, they want sheriffs who are beholden to groups of politicians so that they cannot be straight law and order sheriffs. They need to be bureaucrats. On this program, as frustrating as it can be sometimes, we thank the Lord for placing supposedly wise people on tall towers of shaking sand with our feature called The Tower Babbling.
You know about the biblical truth of the Tower of Babel. A Disciple's View presents...
Who doesn't love a yellow school bus?
Trans women are women, trans men are men, and non-binary people are non-binary.
If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money.
The Tower of Babbling.
Three sound bites in the Tower Babbling starting here. Corrupt Illinois Governor Pritzker suggests Trump will try to deport all same-sex attracted people, disabled people, women, and minorities.
After we've discriminated against, deported, or disparaged all the immigrants and the gay and lesbian and transgender people, the developmentally disabled, the women, and the minorities, once we've ostracized our neighbors and betrayed our friends, after that, when the problems we started with are still there staring us in the face, what comes next? All the atrocities of human history lurk in the answer to that question.
Wow, that's a really dark future that's not anywhere on anyone's plans anywhere. So why would a man who is a member of one of the most politically evil families in America. Oh, proof? Okay. They decided to shift their monies that they inherited out of hotel fortunes into medical devices and pharmaceuticals. Just before, his brother, a man who pretends to be a woman, got the so-called human rights campaign really rolling behind the scenes to con parents into transing their kids. There you go. So why would he issue something that is not on anyone's list anywhere? It has to do, of course, with this. They have lost the ability to argue in any other sense than Donald Trump is literally Hitler, and that's not working anymore, and it will not change any minds. And no one, there's going to be no new people hating Donald Trump. That is not going to happen. They've saturated themselves. Next soundbite in today's Tower Babbling. This woman pretends to know that deep inside, her one-year-old son is actually a girl.
So here is my transgender baby. Her name is Bella. Bella was born a boy, but now uses she, her pronouns. I am in the middle of trying to get a doctor's appointment in order to secure some medication to stop the male hormone taking over.
Should there not be a criminal complaint filed? Is that not demonstrably child abuse? What did I just say about the Pritzker family? It's almost like we planned that. Last soundbite in today's Tower Babbling, speaking of Democrats, people like Pritzker, the biggest, most tragic joke of a mayor, Karen Bass, said this about her decision to go on a trip while Los Angeles was about to burn.
Two investigations are taking place, one internal to the city, and that's the fire commission, because that's mandated by the city charter. Mm-hmm. So the commission will hire an outside entity to examine everything, the pre-deployment, you know, why were firefighters sent home, you know, all of that that should have taken place that didn't. And then also the governor has contracted, so everything that happened, including that, needs to be examined.
When she says including that, that's the key. You know what she's asked? Why did you get to go on vacation when you knew that there was a fire in the way? She's telling us that a commission is going to look into why she was allowed to do what she decided to do. Got it? And that's a wrap for today's Tower Babbling.
That is called Bidenomics. That is called Bidenomics, and we are very proud of Bidenomics.
That was the Tower of Babbling on A Disciple's View.
On a personal note today, if you would like to rescue America, get fathers to go to church with their sons. There you go. America rescued. Am I overstating this? I don't think so. I don't think so. I am gifted to work with young men. And on very few occasions have I met their fathers. Very few. In 3 years, twice. Now, fathers are busy people. That is a true fact. I'm a father. My daughter is chronologically adult, and I am busy. And I make time for her. I invite her to church. She's chronologically adult. She can choose to not go. Sometimes she does. I am not the perfect father. Far from it. Far from it. But we don't see the dads come and visit with us. And sometimes it's, well, that's my kid's space. Okay. But what we do see is boys who are coming in being parented by older boys, by culture. And when they learn what fathers do biblically, when we talk about biblical description of fatherhood, I think you would be very, very, very hard-pressed to not get tears in your eyes when they realize their dads don't know how to biblically father. These young men, almost across the board, respect their dads. Some don't. Some don't know their dads. Some just cannot respect how their dads treat their moms. But about 75% of them respect their dads. And it's this: my dad works. Our family eats. We have a lake cabin and boats, and we get to play. And when we talk about the biblical description of fatherhood, those boys are also hit hard. And we emphasize this every single time. Respect your parents that you might live long in the land. Love your parents because they love you. We always, always effort to talk about their parents in respectful ways because we feel that. We don't make judgments about their folks. I mean, we can be discerning, and sometimes we are. But we also communicate that we ourselves, me, I didn't know how to be a biblical parent. And parenting, fathering is so vital. I think often of this time where I had the gift of being an assistant coach on my junior high wrestling team. I graduated high school. I was playing a little bit of community college football at a little tiny community college. And part of my work study was I got gifted with a cool work study job One was driving through the parking lot to make sure the sprinklers were on. Yeah, work study. The other was showing up to be an assistant coach at my junior high. And my coach, he'd been my coach. He was still there. He actually let me coach a complete match. Man, it was a joy. There was a young man on our team named Chris. And the moment I saw him, I recognized him as an utterly brilliant wrestler by the way he moved in and out of shots, his agility, his strength, his focus. He was, anyone who knew wrestling would walk in and go, he's going to be a state champ. So I got to coach him during a match, one of his first matches. And he was terrible. He was stiff. He was like a wooden board. He couldn't move. He wouldn't move. I finally went out and made a joke because the boy he was wrestling got a bloody nose. I finally went out and said, hey, Chris, do you know that cheerleader over there? He goes, which one? With the other team there, the girl in the middle, the blonde girl. No, I go, wow, she really likes you. She does? Yeah. Well, that took his mind off of whatever was going on. And he came out in about 15 seconds. He pinned that kid just like he should have. And then I realized something. His dad had been screaming at him from the stands, screaming criticisms. And I asked Chris later, hey, did your dad play sports? Yeah, he was a professional hockey player. Oh. I invited his dad to practice on Monday. And he came in towards the wrestling room, and I stopped him. We had double doors and windows he could see through. I said, Miss, I don't want to say his last name on the air, but sir, will you stand here and watch your son? And he stood there and he watched his son, and they were doing man in the middle. So Chris was the varsity kid. He had to wrestle all the junior varsity guys time and time and time again. And he looked at me and goes, why doesn't he move that way around me? I didn't have to answer. He said, oh Lord. Yeah, he's afraid of you. God gifted me with that. If you want your country back, man, get the fathers to church. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Because we believe, we speak. Because He first loved us, we speak His Word. We walk in the path of Jesus Christ to make disciples of all nations. And so God gives us permission to speak again together. May His peace wash over you. On behalf of Randy and AFR, I'm Todd Herman. This has been A Disciple's View.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.